You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 19th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Joining us will be Cliff Schechter. Also on the program, Mark Maron is sitting down with the President of the United States, Barack Obama, today. So we have one-upped him by inviting the original Obama bot, Andy Kindler, onto this program. Advantage Majority Report. Also on the program today, the killer, terrorist killer of nine African-Americans in a church in South Carolina was captured yesterday. We know more about his intentions, or I should say, we know more specifics about his intentions. We all knew his intentions, except, of course, it seems, the luminaries in the Republican Party, who even today are claiming they don't know why he did what he did, and maybe it has to do with the fact that these people were Christian. Also, the Confederate flag still flying at full mast at the state capitol in South Carolina. Meanwhile, a vote yesterday in the House to promote fast-track authority, more and more intrigue as to what will happen on the Senate side, and a hint as to how King v. Burwell may end up being decided, and it all has to do with scheduling assignments. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders may have a problem getting on the ballot in New Hampshire and in New York, according to pieces that came out yesterday, perhaps an indication of how much concern there is with his rising popularity. Donald Trump backs up a little bit, says he may have been too mean on Jeb Bush, and the FCC halts robocalls and will increase access to the internet amongst low-income families across the country. All that and more on today's program. We're going to go right in to pick up the phone on Cliff. Just want to remind you folks that it is your support that makes this program possible. Want to thank our members. You can become one at majority.fm. If you drink coffee, which I imagine a lot of people do, I am right now as I speak. Well, not as I speak. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm. You go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your crap there. We get a little bit of a kickback. And also iTunes reviews. It's Friday. great day to leave us a review on iTunes and pick up the app if you ever want to IM the show, or if you want access, if you're a freebie, to the last 50 shows. If you are a member, you can actually get the archive. Now, you don't have to, that doesn't mean download all the shows onto your thing. It just means records and access to the past 1,200 shows that we've done if you are a member. So check that out. I also want to say sort of a belated anniversary, but longtime listeners of this program will recall that 11 years ago, minus 24 hours, Janine Garofalo was hosting, well, I guess really minus 12 hours. Janine was not flying solo on the Majority Report that night. Tim Robbins came in to fill in for me. And Nikki and I, we actually got married on a Friday, but then had the sort of the party on a Saturday. We had just gotten married. We were getting into, I think it was our car, or I don't know where it was. Turned on the radio, could hear Air America up there. We were got married upstate. There was a, and could hear Tim Robbins and Janine talking about how we must have just gotten married. Aww. Yeah, there you go. And so last night, Nikki and I had dinner and then went to see a movie. And then about 5 minutes into the movie, we ended up seeing different movies. Yeah, happy anniversary, sweetheart. I'm going to go downstairs and watch a different movie. It was because of that 3D, but we'll talk about that later, maybe with Andy Kindler. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter. Sam Seder on the Majority. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday, and that means that we play this theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.com.
Well, we play that song, ladies and gentlemen, because Cliff Schechter himself is actually on the phone on every Friday that we're fortunate enough to have him. Cliff, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be here as always.
Yes. You know, we would have, were it not for the killings yesterday in really a massacre that took place in South Carolina yesterday, we would be obviously talking about the TPP and Donald Trump's inclusion into the clown car. Maybe we'll get to some of that. But, you know, I think most listeners or many listeners on this program know that you have been involved in working for the idea of some type of gun control in this country. I don't know that this one massacre would have been able to be stopped had we had more legitimate gun control laws. Although, you know, the guy apparently, this 21-year-old guy went in, purchased a gun with money that he'd gotten for his birthday present. I think yesterday I said the gun was given to him as a gift, but it turns out he actually purchased it. We know that he had had run-ins with the law. Perhaps that would have been on his records, or maybe it would have been more difficult for him to purchase a gun. But that's only one part of this story.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's many parts of the story, although they're all pretty well related. When it comes to the actual aspect of whether this could have been prevented or not, you know, that's sort of the box that the loons on the right try to force you into every time one of these things happens, which is, you know, you must find the exact law, how this could have been prevented. And, you know, that's not really the point with all this, because the driving factor behind this is that we have a gun culture in this country that has existed in other countries too, and is extreme, and it's violent. It's very racist to the core. I'm going to talk more about that. You know, it's you know, with these anti-government militias and hate groups, and that's on purpose, because this goes back a long way, and that is how certain people profited. It is how certain people always have profited. Again, I'll get to that, but just in whether this could have been prevented or not, here's the thing. All right. What we do know is, and I feel like I'm a broken record because I said this again and again, but I guess I can't say it enough times. What we do know is this, which is, you know, a country that used to have not as many of these, but one of these a year, much a smaller population than ours, which is Australia, that also had a frontier history. After their Newtown, if you want to call it that, or AME Church, if you want to call it that, the Port Arthur Massacre, they set about passing a strict regimen of gun regulations to completely change the culture they had there, which was probably just about as loose as our culture was around guns. That was in, it was 94, 95, mm-hmm. around there. They have not had one massacre since then. Their suicide rate, because guns are by far the most effective way to commit suicide, has gone down 60-70%. Their homicides with guns have gone down something like 70%. It has been a wholesale change. All right, we've seen these laws work all across Europe and all across other parts of the world. We've seen the fact that the only state that's not contiguous in this country on land, Hawaii, which is a great place to look at because they choose to have a very different culture than the rest of this country, and where they've got the most stringent, probably, or close to the most stringent gun laws, and they also have the lowest level of gun ownership, they also have the lowest level of gun violence. And if you compare states within this country, it's pretty simple. All the ones with the most gun violence, Louisiana, Mississippi, Utah, places like that are where you have the most guns. Okay, so that's you know, to start all this off, I'll also give the most recent example very quickly of where you see two different the difference in how two states have acted. Before, you know, the NRA created kind of our modern culture around guns and really played upon the worst aspects of us. The 20th century or even the 19th century saw a lot of regulations of guns. Their concealed carry was banned in many states, Wyoming, Kentucky, places that you wouldn't believe it now. And they, you know, and so one of the sort of leftover laws from that period of time, Missouri had a handgun permit system. All right. Connecticut didn't have this. Connecticut passed a law to make sure that you would have to go to a police station and get a background check there and get a license, and then you could go buy a gun. Since they did that, their gun violence rate has gone down, or gun homicide rate has gone down 40%.
Wow.
Since Missouri, about four or five years ago, revoked theirs, because in their modern gun crazy newer sort of rendition of themselves, their gun homicide rate has gone up 25%. So again, this isn't hard to figure out.
Right.
But let's get to the base of all this, which is at the very center, the crucial center of our modern conservatism, and that of course includes the gun nut movement, which is a very key part of this whole thing. Is race. It just is. And from the dawn of, you know, the time of the Civil War, when you had most of the Southern soldiers who were fighting against the North did not own slaves. This was their, let's call it, top 1% back then, would own, you know, they would do some, you know, the old phrase, waving the bloody shirt, All right. They would do what they could to say, oh, the North is coming and doing this, you know, all black people are doing that. And they did what they could to incite people who are much more working class origins to rise up, because if you could direct them, it wouldn't be directed at you. And, you know, that has been the story of this country. I mean, for a short period of time during Reconstruction, there were actual reforms being passed in the South. Changes were being made. African Americans were starting to serve in elected office and starting to have at least some semblance of power. And then you had the corrupt bargain where Rutherford B. Hayes, from the state I'm sitting in, sadly, there was the sort of the pre-George W. Bush election where Florida was potentially stolen. And having that, the deal that he made was when they gave him the presidency that he would pull Northern troops out of the South. And that is when Jim Crow began in earnest. And that is when, again, just like during the Civil War, the gun was a key thing that was used, because this is what, whether it's the, you know, whether it's the police who are in on this, you know, often with the Klan, if you want to, you know, if you want to look at the, you know, the Mississippi burning case, the famous case of the three Northern civil rights workers who were abducted and murdered, and the police were knee deep in that. But if you want to look at the whole culture of resistance, because then in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was kicking off his presidential campaign, Jesse Helms, a name from our past, in this very same battle, took Reagan to Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is where those three slain civil rights workers had disappeared, to proclaim Ronald Reagan's support for states' rights. And this is all connected. You know, it was the big government, you know, with a phrase I love to use, of the North coming in and forcing, you know, Southerners to live with blacks. And again, let me be very clear here that I'm not referring to all Southerners. I'm talking about a culture here. There are many great progressive Southerners, as there are in all parts of this country. And frankly, there's a lot of rural areas, even some that are not so rural, the Midwest and other regions of this country, that are filled with racism. So, but overall, you know, this is what we're looking at. And so, you know, the sort of tying of any program to do with, you know, taxation, regulation, everything with, you're helping those people. It's the same as the waving the bloody shirt. And this has been going on. And if you look at who the NRA appeals to, I mean, our crime rates have been going down. The NRA, the modern incarnation, was taken over in 1977 by the hard right, including the guy at the time who led the organization, who was accused in the 1930s of murdering a young Hispanic kid because he felt like it and got off on a technicality. That's who founded the modern NRA. And it's all based around race. You listen to Wayne LaPierre's speeches. Who is he talking about who's going to come break into your house? These people, the people he's talking to, aren't picturing some white person coming and breaking into their house. He's referring to Latino gangs and knockout gamers and all those silly things he says. There's a very specific crowd. It's a very specific fear he's playing to. It goes back to, again, to Birth of a Nation and long before that. And this is their model for selling guns. So everything the federal government does is for blacks and not you. So they've made that attachment. And you know, it's hard to, you have to pinpoint every one of these. We'd have to sit here forever. But that's essentially what you've got going on. And so that the gun culture in this country would be inextricably tied to racial resentment, racial hatred, is just common sense. And that's what you're looking at, and that is our modern gun culture. It is not the person who chooses to take their son hunting or the person who chooses to have a gun in their house and locks it up for protection. I'm talking about this group of crazies who put arsenals together and show up at these groups and fetishize their guns and show up on Twitter freaking out on everybody, you know, and when they're talking about having freedom, who is it freedom from? When they're talking about taking their country back, who are they taking their country back from? This all is of one piece. So I'll end where I began.
Yeah, and I think that's it's very well said, and I think that what has amazed me about the reaction is that, you know, that you've just done an incredible job of sort of tying together these different strains of the conservative movement, some of which is, you know, extremely sort of almost pragmatic and self-serving. When you talk about the NRA, it being a trade organization using this racism that has that, you know, there is no greater definition, or I should say no greater issue. Let me rephrase that. There is no issue that is as prominent and in defining the American political experience than race. I mean, it created our economic power. from very early on. It defines our politics and has for the virtually the entire history of this country. And
that's right.
And the NRA and the sort of the gun movement tied into it, and then the states' rights, you know, then you have starting to code, and then of course it has become even far more prominent in terms of partisan politics. Since, I mean, it certainly has been there in our politics from
right.
the, you know, even Social Security at first did not cover
African Americans right.
because FDR had to sell this to the Dixiecrats. You know, these are Democrats. But it becomes where it really becomes caught up in partisan politics, not just politics, but in partisan politics, of course, happens after the 1965 Civil Rights Act, when those Democrats from the South leave the Democratic Party over the next 10, 15 years. Certainly over the past 10 or 15 years from now, we have seen that sort of cycle complete itself. And now it is firmly the Republican Party is
it's a vehicle for that movement.
And what's amazing to me is it has increased. I mean, maybe it just was submerged for a period of time. Maybe it was because there was still some vestiges of Democratic politicians who shared that racism and used that racism. And so it sort of clouded the partisan picture. But over the past 24 hours, to witness three of, and I don't even know what the other presidential candidates have said about this,
right.
but to witness Jeb Bush just moments ago, okay, after first saying we have no idea what's in this guy's mind, this morning, still saying
it's about religious stuff
right.
too.
Not only that, he said just moments ago, Laura Bassett from Huffington Post. Asked him, I asked Bush again if the shooting was racist, because he will not say it, which is just bizarre.
Yes.
And he said, quote,
until
nine people.
Until you know what base they have to appeal to, and then you kind of get it.
Well, he says, let me read this quote. He said, quote, nine people lost their lives, and they were African American. You can judge what it is. What is, and you have, and we'll play
now,
a clip.
If nine people lost their lives in that church had been white and it was a Muslim who did it, I'm sure he would have said the same
thing. Exactly. I mean, we don't even have to draw that analogy because it is so flagrant. It is the efforts being made not to say that this is racist. I mean, we'll move on to their talking points that somehow this was anti-Christian. But the flagrant effort being made here to not say the word racism is borderline bizarre. And if you judge it from the perspective of someone who doesn't understand, who's completely unaware of our politics, who has no idea or no inkling or no reason to believe that racism is actually an asset for a political party, that would be an utterly bizarre statement. But once you understand the history that you've laid out there, once people understand that, like, look, there was a reason why Ronald Reagan kicked off his campaign talking about state rights 3 miles away from where these three civil rights workers had their bodies dumped, you start to understand that this the lead candidate, the establishment most moderate candidate of the Republican field of 15 people, refuses to utter the words racism in regards to a, and this is after
right.
What we know of what his friends have said, what he said, what the survivors of this have said. It is unbelievable.
Well, this is kind of what you and I have talked about, you know, before, which is, you know, the Tea Party and the so-called establishment just having to do with kind of who your friends are and your media training, not what your beliefs are. Really, it doesn't really matter what your beliefs are, what kind of policies you'll support and enact, and what kind of rhetoric you'll use when you can get away with it when the media is not watching. I mean, look, the simple thing is that you said that it hadn't become so clear, and that's because, yes, this has been like any other political transformation, this has been a long-term transformation. It started, as you said, after the Civil Rights Act. I mean, Strom Thurmond walked out of the Democratic Party, as did Mississippi, was it state or UMass college president, Republican college or Democratic, excuse me, college president Trent Lott, as did Jesse Helms, all of whom were Democrats at that point in time. And you know, Haley Barbour, these are the types of people that started moving over to the Republican Party. But it happened first in the deepest parts of the South, where racial animosity had been most extreme because of there being large populations of African Americans and whites side by side. But to get to the point where it's also reached, you know, West Virginia and, you know, other much more rural states with a sort of southernish bent to them, but that weren't on the front lines. I mean, if you think about it, West Virginia was the reason why West Virginia became West Virginia. It split off from Virginia because they were against slavery initially, you know. And so, you know, it starts reaching into the border states and certain sort of western states with a kind of southern, you know, mentality to them, your Oklahomas and Utah. And again, I'm talking about culture. I just want to be clear with all this, not in, you know, every individual.
Well, of course not. But I mean,
so it's been a long-term transformation is what it's been. But the guy who sort of set up, I'll just say quickly, I know you want to jump in, Sam, who kind of helped set up the plan, if you want to call it that, to do this, the Southern Strategy, one of the key architects of that, of course, was Roger Iles.
Right.
And that's why when people refer to Fox, they just say, look at what he did with Nixon. Fox, he's done exactly the same thing.
Yep.
I mean, it literally is the same exact formula. He realized what he did with the party, he could also do with a news channel. And that has helped aid and abet this mentality and push it further. And then it's become kind of like this sort of vicious cycle between the politicians, between talk radio and Fox. We're back, they're batting it back and forth, and everybody has to seem more extreme than everybody else. You know, and so that these are all important aspects of it too, is that it couldn't have happened without the full media support that's been behind it.
But it's just amazing to me. I mean, I'm going to play some sound here, okay? And I want to make something clear. I mean, you've said this a couple times, and I want to just sort of make this point clear that we're talking about it. It's one thing to say that, yes, of course, not everyone in the South is racist. Not all Republicans are racist. There are racist Democrats. In fact, for a while, they were a voting bloc in the Democratic Party when we called them Reagan Democrats. For the most part, that was driven. I mean, to a large extent, the Democratic Party has moved, broadly speaking, to a different coalition that is not as racist or did not have the same sort of relative strength of racist elements. But, I mean, let's just play this clip first. Let's start with this clip. Jeb Bush, this is the first thing he said. Remember, he followed this. I'll remind people what he followed this up with. But this is what he said. This is indicative of a guy who is trying to run for the Republican presidential nomination, knows he has trouble with a large percentage, 50% of the Republican base.
At least some of that isn't because of who his wife and his kids are.
Very possibly. But we can tell you this. We can assure you from this comment that this is what he thinks. And he's the expert, right? He's the expert running towards these people. Please.
Our hotel was literally a block away from the AME church, and it was not appropriate to continue the campaign. But it is appropriate to mourn because...
No, what happened? Just play the Bush clip. Go start again. Don't go.
Our hotel was literally a block away from the AME church, and it was not appropriate to continue the campaign. But it is appropriate to mourn because we know that a house of God is a house of peace and brotherhood, and the violence that took place in that church just breaks our heart. And this was an evil act of aggression. I don't know what was on the mind or the heart of the man who committed these atrocious crimes, but I do know what was in the heart of the victims.
Now, put aside the fact that Jeb seems to know what was in the heart of the victims, but...
Maybe he can figure out some hearts, but not others.
Right, right. And then I'll remind people, followed up, Laura Bassett, I think from Huffington Post, I asked Bush again if the shooting was racist. He said, quote, 9 people lost their lives and they were African American. You can judge what it is. How is it that this guy who has so many other judgments, ranging from the most banal to the most sophisticated, cannot call this a racist act? Why is he so determined not to say that? That tells you everything you need to know about the Republican Party.
If I can remind you something quickly, which is, you know, to further tie what I was talking about earlier into each other, the first Stand Your Ground law, which of course many people know the history now with Trayvon Martin being murdered and others, and the large percentage of those cases that are whites who just feel fear and decide they have to kill somebody black. And remember, it's what's in their minds that counts. They thought it was they were under some sort of an attack, even if some African-American was just walking by them. That was Jeb Bush who led that charge and passed that first law in Florida before it went out to other states. So just keep that in mind, and that is a law that is as close to being blatantly racist as possible.
Okay, so now we've covered Jeb Bush, the establishment candidate, the supposed moderate candidate, the front-runner candidate in the Republican Party, refusing multiple times to say the words racism in regards to this attack. Let's go on to Lindsey Graham, who is on The View, I guess, was it this morning? On The View this morning. Remember, this is after. We now know if it wasn't enough that this guy was, there was pictures circulating with this guy with an apartheid patch, with a Rhodesia flag patch.
Yeah.
If that wasn't enough, if it wasn't enough to know that he said to people, which we all knew yesterday, that you people rape our women, you all have to go. If that wasn't enough, we now know as of this morning when he goes on The View that his roommate had been talking about how this guy was into segregation, how his friends had talked about this guy was racist.
How he said he wanted to start a race war.
How he wanted to start a race war. All this, Lindsey Graham goes on, and now he is, and yesterday we talked about Fox and Friends pushing this talking point, and it was so, like, shocking. But the idea that a candidate of the Republican Party presidential nomination, like Lindsey Graham, who has taken this seriously, would say this. Don't come and tell me that Donald Trump is a buffoon and a joke because of what he says. When you hear what Lindsey Graham is dancing around here, the only difference between anything offensive that Donald Trump says and what Lindsey Graham says here is just a little more media training and having worked in a slightly different context in his professional career. That's the only difference in terms of what's offensive here. Let's play this Lindsey Graham on The View. This was, I guess, yesterday.
One thing it's not, let's talk about what it's not in my view. It's not a wind into the soul of South Carolina.
No.
It's not who we are. It's not who our country is. It's about this guy. This guy has got tons of problems, and to kill people in a church after sitting there with them for an hour, tells you how whacked out this kid is.
And leaving somebody alive so they can tell the story.
Mm-hmm. So let's tell him a story.
Yes, and this congregation, you know, inside the church was established in 1816. Yeah.
Well, the pastor is a good buddy. He was in the state senate, and one of the nicest guys in all of politics, and you know, I can't explain this. I don't know what would make a young man at 21 get so sick and twisted to kill 9 people in a church. This is beyond my understanding.
Do you think that it's a hate crime? Do you feel like it's a hate crime? Or do you think it's more mentally disturbed?
Probably both. One probably precludes the other. There are real people out there who are organized to kill people in religion and based on race. This guy's just whacked out. But it's 2015. There are people out there looking for Christians to kill them.
Looking for Christians to kill them?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on.
I mean, honestly, is there any adult in the country who believes that? Is there any reporter who can honestly say, like, that Donald Trump is a buffoon for what he says, but Lindsey Graham is somehow legitimate when he says this crap?
No, and let's be clear here also. To have somebody, okay, who is a senator from South Carolina sitting there saying this, somebody in a state that, of course, flies the Confederate flag, that was that before even the Civil War was the first place where the movement for nullification began in the 1830s, based upon the battles over whether there'd be slaves in new territories or not. I mean, the history in South Carolina is so long and so steeped in racism. the culture there. It's just, it's unbelievable. And what could be in this guy's mind? How could that happen here? I don't know. Could he have looked up? Could he have looked at, you know, could he have been walking along Calhoun Street? You know, could he have been walking on Gadsden Street?
All right, let's talk about this, because the other aspect about this that is just sort of, it's just stunning, is that Nikki Haley, of course, who also had no idea what could possibly have motivated this guy, flags were at half mast in South Carolina yesterday, except for the Confederate flag. And Chris Hayes interviewed in South Carolina Mark Sanford, who is now what a congressman from South Carolina, former governor. Had some indiscretions, had to resign. That story is sort of secondary here. And I want to go through this, but as we listen to this audio, and we'll stop it in a moment, but I want to read just one thing in a great Ta-Nehisi Coates piece.
No, I haven't when read we, that one yet. I want to, definitely.
When we talk about the Confederate flag, and it's actually just a symbol of heritage, right? It has nothing to do with racism. It has to do with just the heritage of the South. He quotes the Confederate vice president in Georgia of 1861, right on the verge of the, or the beginning of the Civil War. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This is the vice president of the Confederacy. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. This moral truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man.
Yeah.
I mean, let's listen to Mark Sanford tell us why this
quickly,
is really about heritage.
Just to connect another strand here, does that sound so different to Cliven Bundy's "Let's Talk About the Negro" speech?
No, I mean, come on.
Here we are where we are today, and this is the guy that all these guys defended with all of his guns, is refusing to pay big government because there's all the black people on welfare, which he said, but that's how he began. Let's talk about the Negro. I mean, it's just, you know.
All right, well, let's play this clip of Chris Hayes discussing with Mark Sanford the legitimacy of the Confederate flag. And I will say, you know, coming from, well, let's just play this clip.
Can't but think of how awful it must be if you're someone in mourning in that church with that history, and you're hearing all this rhetoric about how we're coming together and we're healing, we're united South Carolinians, black and white, and you know that that flag today is up there, that flag that was apparently beloved by this alleged gunman, as a symbol of violence and domination.
Right.
Like, how can you make sense of your state actually fully embracing you and seeing you in this moment of grief when that thing is flying on those grounds?
What I'd say is, as with any other political compromise, it will be imperfect. And so if you go back in time, what you'd find was a guy named John Rainey and a guy named Lonnie Randolph. Lonnie Randolph was then head of the NAACP. John Rainey was a well-regarded businessman, philanthropist, and state. They and others worked together with both the business community, the political community, and the church community to say, how do we take it off the state house ground, which
this
is where
is
it was
correct.
At the time.
Pause
and
it.
They put up,
pause it. Now here, what Sanford's saying is, well, it's not on the state house. It's just on the state house grounds. And we evened it out by having a memorial to black slaves. This is what he's saying here. Continue.
Right.
An African-American memorial. They put it on the grounds. It was imperfect. So I think it's easy from afar. The Bible says, you know, worry about the log in your own eye before you worry about the splinter in somebody else's. To say, well, why didn't you guys get it right or more right? Because
pause
I think
it.
That was the best.
Pause it. All right, you hear what he said there?
I want to go straight to the Bible. There.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, but he's saying it's easy from afar. In other words, you northerners come down here and judge us again. And why don't you look in your own backyard before you complain about this huge symbol of, yeah, of racism, right? I mean, this is exactly what we've been talking about in terms of, well, this is really about, you know, northerners coming here and telling us how to treat our black people.
That's right. All right. Big government coming in and telling us how to treat our people and how to live. And it's all about that.
All right. Continue.
Could be done at that time. It does not make it a perfect political solution, but it means it was a solution at the time.
What's the answer to why that's the case? Because this is to many people, it is a symbol of tyranny. It's a symbol of white supremacy. It's a symbol of domination.
It is, but again, to another population in this state, it's a symbol of heritage, it's a symbol of state rights, it's a symbol of my great-great-grandfather died in some battle in Manassas.
So there it is. Well, yes.
But why did he die in that battle? What was it he was defending by dying in that battle? And that's what I can't stand is the whole, you know, heritage argument. Well, what heritage is it that you're talking about? Nobody seems to ever go to that next step, which is, well, it's just about heritage. What heritage?
Oh, well, I will quote again from the vice president of the Confederacy in Georgia, 1861. That heritage is this, our new government is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. And yep. So we know what the heritage is, and when we know what states' rights means, we know what that means. Because the problem that the states who wanted their rights, apparently, like Massachusetts, they didn't want their rights, just these states that wanted their rights. The big right that they wanted was to own black people.
Yes,
that
was some very specific rights they wanted.
And we all know about our heritage. I mean, I live in Massachusetts, or I grew up in Massachusetts. Massachusetts, as far as I know, has one of the greatest heritages in the United States. Well, that's where the Pilgrims landed. And for the life of me, you could be flying the Massachusetts flag right in front of me, and unless it says Massachusetts on it, I don't know what that is, and I'm still hanging in there. I still feel pretty good about Massachusetts. All right, continue with this audio.
This is our Bull Run or who knows where. And so,
but yeah, in this case, let's just be clear.
Yeah.
With this, to the extent that this alleged murderer is the person
you think he is,
that's the original meaning of that symbol and what he did, those are not accidentally adjacent.
But they're no more adjacent to me or you than they are to so many people walking Calhoun Street right now, which is to say, what's that? Yeah.
That's
meeting,
my point.
Meeting Street.
It's bigger.
The reason why they're laughing there, and you know this, Cliff, you just mentioned it. It's named after John Calhoun, who was an important politician from South Carolina, who one of his major sort of philosophical tenets was that slavery was something that was positive.
Yeah, he was Martin Van Buren's vice president. He was almost the dawn of where he was pushing for exactly that philosophical statement.
Great proponent of states' rights and nullification, like you say. All right, then let's just finish this up with Sanford.
There's a lot of heritage here. We go back to the 1600s and 1700s. And so you wish you could erase a lot of things in history. But the reality of life is you can't. And so what you can do is what you can do. So when I was governor, I was the first guy
We're done here. So what they say is, look, you can't erase history. We got a lot of heritage here. We've been around since 1700. Oh, my gosh. And you can't erase history. Nobody's talking about erasing it. But if something horrible has happened in your past, the thing to do is not celebrate it, right? I mean, presumably there's a reason why Mark Sanford isn't walking around with a photograph of the woman he left his wife for and basically abandoned the state and reminding people of his affair, right? I mean, because he's been redeemed now. Christ forgave him or whatever it was that washed him of his sins. But he's not walking around celebrating that history, is he?
No, not that I'm aware of. Yes, I mean that's exactly it is that you know, yeah, you've got a long heritage. Yeah, Charleston, that was one of the earlier, you know, settlements, one of the earlier, certainly, port cities in this country. The difference is, you pointed out, you started talking about Massachusetts, and I grew up in New York City, and I'm not saying there aren't any negatives to the heritage of any of those places, but you don't walk around referring to your specific heritage and how long you've been around and getting defensive about why you should be able to keep certain symbols and celebrate certain names. It's just not done. There's a very specific reason, and that's because, again, when we pulled our troops out, when we allowed them to institute essentially 100 years of segregation, of apartheid, we allowed this whole thing, in the end, no pun intended or pun intended, to be whitewashed. And essentially we just said, let's just move forward. And that with every new reform, that's exactly what we've done. So even when we said you can no longer drink from a different water fountain, we never reckoned with what had happened. It was just, you know, stop complaining. Why is there a certain population of people who have a much lower education rate, a higher death rate, you know, less health care and all this? It just must be their own doing. We've never reckoned with it. We've never dealt with it. And when you celebrate it in places like South Carolina by naming streets after generals and reenacting Civil War battles and having a Confederate flag fly atop and everything that they do there and in certain other states, you're telling people this is okay and this is the right way to behave. And when you Rand Paul and one of the guys in your campaign called himself the Southern Avenger and wrote for all these publications saying similar things to what we're saying right now, you're saying that all that was justified and okay. All right, and we go on because the more you look at these guys, John McCain had some of these guys on his payroll. George W. Bush did. You know, I mean, every once in a while, it seemed like every 4 years, when something ugly would happen in the South Carolina primary, like, hey, John McCain has a black child, which was one of the rumor the Bush people pushed out in 2000. You know, then some of South Carolina's ugly history would come up, but then it all just disappears again. And everyone's just supposed to move forward as if we're all coming from the same place and a fair place. And people who are growing up or who are being taught some very racist things ever had to kind of contend with what their ancestors did and be told that they were wrong in doing it. And, you know, that's the reason why they want states' rights, and that's the reason why they want to control their textbooks and all this stuff. I mean, obviously, there's other aspects to it, too, their retrograde views on religion and women and sexuality and whatever. But the race is related to a lot of that, too, and is really still the key factor here.
Yep. You're right. Well, Cliff, we're not going to get to the TPP. We'll hopefully be talking about that next week. And Donald Trump hopefully will also be with us, so we won't have a chance to touch on that.
I have a feeling we'll have some time to talk about Trump.
Indeed. But you know, in the final analysis, you're right. You pull down that flag. All you're simply saying is we should not be proud of those things that this flag represents. You can still have your mint juleps or your fancy cotillions or your debutante balls or your favorite, flower of South Carolina or whatever it is. But this is associated with these principles that black people are inferior and morally belong as our slaves. And so we're going to try and close that chapter, as it were. Cliff, yeah, as always, I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Sam. Take care, man.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to take a quick break and shift gears a little bit. I am sure Andy Kindler will have something to say about Donald Trump, among other things. But I am blown away by the response. I really am. It's a horrific tragedy. But there does not seem to be a will in these people to sort of condemn it. You can't condemn it if you don't concede what it is. Stunning. Really stunning. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Andy Kindler.
Stop breaking down. your mind.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday, and sometimes we get very fortunate. As you know, Marc Maron is interviewing, what's that guy's name? President Obama today. Well, I wonder if Marc Maron and WTF have a theme song for President Obama, because we certainly have a theme song for our next guest, and let's play it now.
With a Jew like Andy Kindler, you know you can't go wrong. His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. A true Obama bot, Andy believes Obama can never be wrong. Yeah, AndyKindler.com. You made me laugh so hard, I had to write you your own theme song, Andy Kindler.
Andy Kindler.
There you go. Only Andy Kindler finishes off his own song live. And you know what? I just went to AndyKindler.com. That's a beautiful website. Look at that.
It is a nice picture there, but there's no, the information never changes. My tour dates from right before Y2K.
Right, I was going to say, 1999. I didn't even realize. Did you just like port this right over from your GeoSites thing? Or?
The thing is, in a world where things are changing and buzzing and lights are flashing, there's a place you can go where everybody, well, they don't know your name, but nothing changes. There's no flash. Static, baby.
Right. This is not, there's no Ajax. There's no, you don't need any. It's just a picture of you looking forlorn, what it looks like near the Tappan Zee Bridge.
That is the best punchline. What is this guy? Hey, what do you, sir, what's your problem? Did you just get off the Tappan Zee Bridge?
There you go. Where did you take
this
that photo?
This is not your
Where
father's
did you take
website.
That photo? Where did you take
this
that
photo? This is not your father's website, Sam.
Where did you take that photo?
What's that?
Where is that photo from?
My wife, Susan Maljan, is a brilliant photographer.
No, it's a beautiful picture.
I think it's from, I don't know, it's 40, 50 years old, that photo.
There you go. Yes. So, Andy, let's cut to the quick here. What do you make of this?
The chase? How about the chase?
We could cut to the chase too.
I'm on today, Sam. I'm on, baby. Go ahead. Anything you want, I'm ready.
Obama wanted on this show, and I said, "Sorry, it's Andy Kindler's turn in the rotation. You're going to have to just maybe Marin's available, and then yeah, there it goes. It works out for Marin." What do you make of this? What do you think? Do you think Maron's going to ask him any hard questions, or do you think he's going to be like you would be, which would be just sort of completely a sycophant and just sort of in awe of the president?
I would be. That's what I would do. I would say, you are the greatest. Tell me how I, other things that are amazing about you I don't know. That's my first question would be. How do you do it? Should I call you President Obama? Should I not be bowing down to you right now? That would be my questions. Are we counter-programming? Is that what we are?
Yeah. We're totally counter-programming here.
How did he nail? I love that idea. Why can't I be? How long is he speaking to him for?
I don't know. I think about, I imagine it's going to be maybe a full-size interview. I mean, in many respects, it's pretty historic. I mean, I can name to you, you know, the biggest interviews of like the Bush administration was Brian Williams, coincidentally. and you know, well, there's obviously like the Frost Nixon talks.
That's right.
I wonder if this is going to be quite as challenging with Maron and. But, I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
Get into Benghazi, man.
Yeah, right, he just comes out of nowhere. He's secretly
oh my God.
Getting the politics of Dennis Miller.
Are you guys trying to ruin my career by my appearance? I mean, I have all my eggs in the Marin basket.
It's
now
true.
You guys are dripping with dripping with sarcasm over there.
And contempt.
It's true. It's true. I've noticed that you've done a lot on Marin's TV show the past. I mean, I got to say, it's like it seems to like bring you in for like one line at somewhere where you're eating, and that's about it.
Well, it's because the other lines don't work out well. I had 40 or 50 lines, but you know, this thing I have where I go, don't look at the camera, don't look at the camera, don't look at the camera, boom. Next thing I know, I'm delivering everything right down the barrel.
Oh, my God.
I can't hear the people laughing in the studio today.
Andy, it's coming. Can I ask a non sequitur question?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, have you heard Sam, or for that matter, I's Dennis Miller impression yet?
Oh, I want to hear this.
You want to give him a little, Dennis Miller?
Bop, 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 bop.
What's that?
That's it. Bop, 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 Benghazi.
Bam.
Yeah, we got to get there. Come on. Just show him a little of ISIS. Will treat him like a bop, 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 bop.
Like Captain Kirk on the holodeck with the bop, 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 bop. Benghazi Obama taxes, okay?
I love his commercials. He's got the greatest commercials. It's the saddest. The last thing he thought of when he was one of the best comedians in the world in that black and white video was that years from now he'd be saying, yeah, there's new mints called Smart Mouth. Smart Mouth, they're mints.
I haven't seen that ad.
Come on. You can't see it because it's on AM radio. Can't see it.
I didn't realize.
Garlic's good for your heart, but it smells bad. So,
Andy Kindler with so many insights. It's like the tribbles are dropping down.
Hey, Sammy. What's your name, Sam? How's it going, Sammy? The Samster. The Samster.
Andy,
Obama's got more troubles than the three sisters with Karashnikov from Crime and Punishment with a reference from the Middle Ages tied up with something from the Renaissance.
And Star Trek. How come you forgot about Star Trek, the original?
Star Trek.
I don't like the later ones because you can't see. They don't wear the little mini skirts. You can't see the gams on those girls.
Ahura had nice sticks.
Yeah, why are you hiding the sticks?
Hey, there's another product I sell.
So Andy,
go to my PC. Why do these right wing talk shows always sell memory things? Like, oh, you don't want to forget your the racist things you might say. Don't forget to back them up.
Yeah, that's right.
This way you'll never forget the president's black. Ba, 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 ba.
Ba, 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 ba. Yeah, I won't hear. What was the thing I said about Obama? What did I call Obama? What were those horrible things I said about Obama? Well, now I can access
if you've forgotten all my smart aleck jokes about the French when we went into Iraq. Back them up on that ba, 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 ba service. Andy.
What a horrible, horrible man.
Horrible.
I mean,
horrible.
If you think of, he's on his best behavior when he's on the radio. Can you think of how terrible he must be in person? Well, actually, I've seen him in person.
All right, look, Andy, there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, all right?
Okay.
Because I know that you
Let's
got stuff.
It.
You've harassed Donald Trump online for ages. And so I know you want to talk about that. Brian Williams, one of your best buddies. But really, let's start with Jerry Seinfeld. Because poor Jerry Seinfeld. You know, go ahead. You go. You go.
No, you set it up.
Jerry Seinfeld, obviously, everybody knows who he is. And he is apparently whining because the colleges which he never plays at are not hospitable to his humor, which doesn't in any way push any boundaries and has never been interesting ever. Apparently, he's not going to play the colleges that he was never going to play in the first place because, you know, how many parking lots do you need to be built into your building anyways for all your cars?
The thing is, well, first of all, this is an example of, you know how sometimes something will happen, you go, well, that wasn't even based on much. It was based on nothing. He played no college. He had no negative experience. His whole theory was based on things that he heard people say, his friends say about playing colleges. An offhand remark, he has a conversation with his daughter. She makes an offhand remark about something being sexist. And this is what he builds his whole theory on. And it all is because he has this bit where he says, all of a sudden I'm a gay French king, right?
But was that the bit? Wasn't the problem that originally, like a year or two ago, at some forum, he was talking about his Comedians with Cars show? And somebody said, how come you never have any black comedians on there? And,
he doesn't care about gender, right?
Or gender or whatever it was, or female comedians. And then he basically enlists Ellen Cleghorn when he does his Saturday Night Live, 100 years of Saturday Night Live or whatever it was, and gets Ellen Cleghorn to sort of basically justify his racism and sexism by getting up there and sort of like tacitly saying, oh, everything you do is fine, Jerry.
Right. Yeah, everything you do is fine. But I also love the idea that, like Lenny Bruce, the first time he got, he said something that was, Richard Pryor said something that's controversial. What if those guys had been like Seinfeld? I don't like this.
Right.
That guy's
exactly.
Looking at me funny in the third row. That's not fair. I want to stop comedy now. What's the point? I mean, what risks has he taken? Zero risks. And the things he said historically, I can go back. I mean, he said the things like the audience, John Seinfeld said things like, the audience is always right.
Right.
You should be able to make every crowd laugh. Because he's another comic who's invested. He's got to be killing all the time. And nothing bad can happen to Jerry Seinfeld. Nothing. If anything bad happens to him, you know, he'll do a bit about how having $1 billion is not good anymore.
Right.
It's not worth what it used to be worth.
The white race is under attack. my gay French king didn't kill. White people are under attack.
Really? I mean, I will.
What's the deal with the Voting Rights Act?
To be fair.
They vote. They have rights. What's the deal with that?
To be fair to Jerry Seinfeld, the criticism... To be fair to Jerry Seinfeld, the criticism from college students should be, you were never very funny. That, you know, there's only so much, like, there's a difference between dog and cats and airline food as experienced by women and men, routines that are actually that funny.
Well, the other thing is like, my thing was, like, the only time colleges have ever been good to play is in the movie Woody Allen. I mean, movie Annie Hall.
Right.
That's the only positive call. And in the movie Annie Hall, he says to Diane Keaton, hey, stick around. The next show is going to be completely different. Woody Allen in that movie is doing two completely different sets and getting huge laughs by saying Eisenhower.
Yes, those were the days, right?
Hello? Has anybody seen Annie Hall? I'm losing it, Sam. Sam, we have to start moving these to the evening, these conversations.
Pre-tapes?
You know, it's 4:30 in the morning on the West Coast.
I'm calling. Andy always travels to Maui before we do these interviews.
What's the deal with black flight attendants?
I also love, why do they call them? Why is he? And I love the way all these comics online, they're all of a sudden... it's like they're outraged now by an event that never happened. It never happened. It's not like he ever went to a college. Anybody said anything negative to him. He's never had a negative experience with a college person off stage. It's complete, total garbage what he's doing.
Yeah, why do you think he's doing it? Is it just like it just seems to me that he is pissy about his whole, he still has a bug up his butt because he can't, that episode, Marin actually had an episode a couple of weeks ago, right? Where he talked about how there hasn't been many black people on his show. And he says, you know, I feel bad about it. I don't run in the same circles as black comedians. And at least he sort of owned it, at least in the context of his show. Jerry could have just said the same thing. Jerry could have just said, you know what? Aside from Mario Joyner or wherever that guy is, I don't know any but black comedians, and that's it. That's the end of it. I mean,
extra to steal one of my cars.
I did a show for 8 years about New York, and we had one black guest spot or something, and that's it. And that's fine. I mean, no, it's not fine, but I mean, it's at least he could just own up to it. But instead, it's like some affront to the fact that the whole world does not bend around him enough.
I know, I just can't even believe that. But I can't believe how people, you know, how it resonated, how people kind of like took up the mantle. Well, I can believe that because...
Well, now, what do you think is going on with that? I mean, I think this is one of the diseases that has afflicted comedians in this age of Twitter, and why I love you, Andy Kindler, and only you, literally only you. And I thought about this a lot last night because I was celebrating my anniversary with my wife, and I was just like...
Oh, happy anniversary.
Yeah, I was like, happy anniversary, but I can't stop thinking about Andy Kindler. Because Andy's really the only one that I genuinely love. And it's, you know, part of it might be just because it's from afar. And we don't...
If I was in New York...
If we were living together, I'm sure I would have a different take on it. But a lot of comedians on Twitter, it's all like I have to praise these people because it's part of my marketing plan on Twitter, essentially.
Well, and how about the fact that people? Well, whoever told anybody this is the most ridiculous thing in the world, is this free speech thing. What they really are saying is they want to say whatever they want to say, and they don't want to have your free speech. You must. It's just like with the Charlie Hebdo thing. I never even. I don't know if we talked about this, but like I don't even know. I still don't even quite know what they do over at Charlie Hebdo. But not only do we have to be. Of course, we were all horrified. I mean, nobody should be killed for a cartoon. Nobody. And I always feel like it's weird that people make me stipulate it.
Right.
You know, like I say, well, I don't know if I like the Charlie Hebdo cartoons. They go, well, they shouldn't be killed. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't stipulate that.
Right,
oh, I'm
right.
Sorry. Yeah. So let me make an announcement. I don't think people should be killed for cartoons. I'm 100% with you on that. But then they say, oh, but you also have to say, I am Charlie Hebdo. And you have to say, and I'm not going to say, I don't know. I'm not going to say that this is brilliant stuff. Because because people were killed for it, and so it's the same thing. It's like they don't want you to have any. They want you to be able to. You have to agree that something is. If you object to it, you're somehow stopping them from expressing themselves. But they're stopping you from expressing yourself. I wish there was someone who could say what I'm saying.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the bottom line is like it's basically coming out and saying, not enough people are buying my comedy album. My free speech is being inhibited because people didn't enjoy it. You know what? I mean, honestly, that's what it basically is. You can Jerry Seinfeld, for all I care, can go into Stand Up New York every night of the week and tell racist jokes all he wants. I mean, that's his prerogative. But it's also the rest of the world's prerogative to say, hey, those jokes are racist. We don't like it. I'm not going to buy a ticket to see you anymore.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the whole thing is like, he's so scared. If my gay French king, if I can't say my gay French king material, what am I going to, you know, that's it. It's over for me. This is the end of it.
Well, it's not just the end of it for him. It's the end of it for all of us.
Right. And that's the thing, too. It's like, there used to be these lines in vaudeville, Sam, which you know I'm an expert about, but these lines like, "Hey, nice to see you back in men's clothes again."
Right.
I didn't even know what that meant when I was. I'm still not quite sure. But the idea, like, yeah, maybe it was funny at one point to say that this guy, what is that guy dressed up like a girl? You know, what's that guy dressed like a woman and he's a man? Well, yes, now there are people who are dressed up like women who are men. So at some point, we're going to have to accept that that's the way people are expressing themselves, and you're not going to end. Your career's not going to end because you can't do all of your tranny jokes.
Right,
that's not
exactly.
Mean the end of comedy as we know it, and I don't know if it's they're scared that they can only do stuff that's based on certain amount of people hating something. But it's like, yes, I understand that there is a point about political correctness, but that's not the point. Isn't like the first controversial thing I say, if it's not accepted, that I'm going to say it's the end of comedy. Where meanwhile, Lenny Bruce really couldn't play somewhere. Literally, yes. Was stopped from playing anywhere.
Was actually arrested on stage. Was right. Literally arrested on stage, and he was not. You know, and let me ask you this about the. You know, the. I listened to somebody had suggested listen to Marin with the Kurt. I can't remember his name. He's from. He writes on.
Kurt Metzger,
and
yeah.
I actually I enjoyed the interview, and he sounds like a funny guy to me.
He is a funny guy.
And he was one who gets who's upset at the blogs taking him on and whatnot. And you know, from my perspective, it's like, look, I personally don't get offended by people using certain words. I don't. I just don't. But the idea that you demand, because I'm making a joke, and then of course, you know, every comedian is the expert about what's funny. That's fine. I am too. I sold a lot of pilots. I made a lot of money. So for the rest of my life, I get to determine what's funny and what's not. Okay. But the bottom line is, they all say the only thing that's important is that it's funny. Well, different people have different senses of humor, A and B. Okay. And on top of that, it's like, just because you're making a joke does not put you into some type of zone where nobody's allowed to be offended because I'm making a joke. Like, I'm in a special zone, the joke zone. And ever since that, you know, Bud Friedman put that one brick on top of the other to make that wall, all of a sudden, yeah, we all left our blood and sweat and tears there.
Well, let's take a perfect example. You know, I definitely believe like that there is this like knee-jerk political correctness or whatever.
Sure.
So, for example, perfect example, when Colbert, we all know Colbert, I believe Colbert's he does genius comedy as far as I'm concerned. He does, you know, satire, nobody better than him. So when it all came out that they had taken out of context or whatever, they did one line from his bit. And then all of a sudden, this cancel Colbert thing.
Yeah, no, that was over the Redskins thing, and he had done a bit. Yeah, that's what it was. He had come out and done, I'm going to do a ching chong thing, and he was satirizing, essentially showing like how much racism was involved in the Redskins owner saying, well, we're going to keep the name Redskins, but we're going to contribute to the Native American College Fund or whatever it was. Colbert did a bit satirizing that. An online Twitter activist basically said, you know, don't use Asian people as the butt of your jokes, and had every right in my mind to say, you know, to do hashtag cancel Colbert. But I still thought that what Colbert said was funny. I thought the satire was good, and that's my opportunity to judge it. But it's like, you know, good for Colbert for not coming out and saying like, my freedom of speech is being curtailed. He didn't whine about it. He just did.
Yeah. And what happened? Is Colbert gone now? Is his career off? No, he's taking over for Letterman. So right. It's like the whole idea that, oh, if we can't have a climate where we have to nip this in the bud, anybody objecting to what we're saying, because it'll be the end of comedy. I hate to say this because my act is based on things being terrible. I think there's more funny comics today saying more innovative things and saying anything they want, and they can be gay. And, you know, I'm not saying there's no sexism and there's no, segregation in comedy, and there aren't the same problems that there are in every single field. But the idea that it's the same thing with Patton Oswalt when Salon incorrectly went after Patton Oswalt for doing what I thought was a hilarious joke about the Chinese, they got the Chinese pilots' names wrong. Patton Oswalt still has a career. Stephen Colbert still has a career. The argument is false on its face, if that makes any sense, that we have to accept all these. I have to say, I'm in favor of you drawing Muhammad with his balls hanging down to the floor.
Right.
Because if I don't say I love that, then the terrorists win or something like that.
Right, you know, or the forces of political correctness. I mean, give me a break. Colbert was funny about it in terms of their response, and it, you know, his career continues. In fact, I would argue that if you can't make a joke, if you can't be funny in response to the to what they're saying, then you should hand in your comedy card.
How many women does it take to change a light bulb? Wait, I'm in the comedy bubble. What's the problem? How dare you be offended? How many Puerto Ricans does it take? Wait, what? You're there's no free speech left. It's over. What will I do besides watch my interests appreciate?
Exactly.
I'm just going to take my car elevator from floor number one to floor number four over and over again. I'm going back to floor number four. I can't take it anymore.
Even now, I know how Mitt Romney... No, I can't even
exactly.
Now I know how Mitt Romney feels. Even my daughter doesn't like the Swami Romney jokes.
If only I was Latino, I wouldn't get any of this grief.
If I was black, everybody would love my Samsung Ayatollah routines. And the gay French stuff would kill.
All right. Andy.
If I was Guatemalan, it would all kill.
That's right. If only I was born in sub-Saharan Africa, I wouldn't have any of these problems.
If I was from Sudan, I would have gone to Harvard and I would have 5 Mark Twain Awards.
I don't want to live in a world where the sock in the dryer bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Rip the cover.
Exactly.
And the thing is, I love the show. This is what gets me so upset. I love the show. I'm still watching reruns of Seinfeld.
Yes, but let's be honest.
It's like
Larry David.
If it wasn't for that show, Seinfeld, you would not think of Jerry Seinfeld as a cutting edge comedian.
Exactly. You know? He seems to have forgotten that. This guy would have been, you know, made Jay Leno look like a cultural critic.
Think about this. A Dominican running a laundromat instead of a Korean. Unlimited comedic possibility. This could get killed because of the colleges. Cutting edge.
Andy.
There's nothing sympathetic. I just can't even believe that anybody would have sympathy for a billionaire upset about getting a bad look. He got a bad look on his gay friend.
Right,
it's
right,
not even like
right,
they didn't
exactly,
laugh.
Right.
They didn't double over.
Right. Right.
They were like, time out, Jerry, time out. I'm laughing so hard. Gay French king.
Andy, we're going to have to talk about Donald Trump another day.
He is the great. Look, some people, they're rapists. The Mexicans that come over, I have a friend. He always has a friend. Right. I got a border guard friend.
Right.
He told me. And he goes, I assume some of them are nice, is what he said.
Yes. Assume some of them are nice people.
He also thinks it's like, I swear to God, he thinks it's like Cuba. Remember when Cuba sent all those people over? He thinks the people from Mexico are being sent over by the government.
Yes, he thinks that they're all being mass deported.
Look who they're sending us. He says that every other sentence.
Right, as if there is like some, like, there's like one of those like T-shirt cannons. And we're just... The Mexican government just line up. It's like the Hunger Games. We're gonna draw from the provinces. We're gonna take you to Mexico City, and then we're gonna catapult you. Andy,
I'm starting to think that he might not be the answer to all of our problems.
Andy Kindler, always a pleasure.
I love you, Sam. I love you. And I'm sorry it took me about 20 minutes to warm up.
No, it was always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
I love you, man.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Andy Kindler, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let's take a... are we doing a Freebie Friday?
We actually have the return
of Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Let's play that, and then we'll go out, and then we'll do some extra members' time, as it were.
Jimmy Reefer Cake writes, like a phoenix rising from the ashes, ashes of reefer, Jimmy Reefer Cake is back with a tune about the winning strategy. Don't fight if you can sometimes agree. The song is called Don't Fight.
All right. And let me just also say that in honor of Jimmy Reefcake, it was Delaware, I think, just decriminalized marijuana. So number, what is that, 19, I think, including Washington, D.C.? Go ahead.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it. Just make it up right now.
Okay.
Oh. Make up a song.
4 minutes and 20 seconds to make a song.
Don't fight if you sometimes agree. Don't fight with the people you need. Don't fight if you sometimes agree. Just simmer down and smoke us some weed. Everybody's got their own good things. Everybody's got some problems. Libertarian, Christians, Jews, socialist motherfuckers. How about you? Don't fight with the people you need.
Stop the TPP.
Don't fight if you sometimes agree.
And legalize the weed.
Simmer down now and smoke you some weed.
Protect the privacy.
Simmer down now and smoke you some weed.
On this reality.
Everybody's got their own good thing. Christians, Jews, and Muslims too. Everybody's got some problems. Everybody knows we all should have fun. Don't fight with the people you need.
And stop the TPP.
Don't fight if you sometimes agree.
And legalize the weed.
Don't fight with the people you love.
Protect the privacy.
Just praise law from a heaven above.
And stop the TPP.
Spam it down now and smoke you some weed.
I... Quite a return by Jimmy Reefer Cake. I got to say, the applause was the way that he worked in the stop, the TPP. That I thought was wonderful. Folks.
I liked Christians, Jews, and libertarians.
Well, in the better half, I'm going to try and give you an update on what's happening with the TPP. The short story is, I say this because I want you to call your senators, and there's 13 of them that are really 13 Democrats who voted for fast track the first time around in the Senate when it was attached to the TAA, which was the Trade Assistance Adjustment Assistance. Maria Cantwell, Ben Cardin, Tom Carper, Chris Coons, Dianne Feinstein, Heidi Heitkamp, Tim Kaine, Claire McCaskill. I think Tim Kaine might be a good one. Patty Murray. Bill Nelson, Gene Shaheen, Mark Warner, Ron Wyden. If you just heard your senator, call them. Because the idea that the senators, that Democratic senators, would trust the Tea Party Republicans in the House to bring up for a vote and to vote in favor of the TAA is a joke. Mitch McConnell, now I'm not, I don't, as far as the Import-Export Bank, I don't care about it. Mitch McConnell promised to have a separate vote on that and screwed over a bunch of people in the Senate. Look, it's not even Boehner to offer at this point that he can do it. So the bottom line is this is the only way that this fast track authority goes down. If these 13 Democrats, if half of them essentially, maybe a little less, do not vote for the TPP, it'll stop it. So you've got to call them. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the show. The number is 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can pick up the app at Majority App. You know the rest. Have a great weekend, folks. We'll be right back after this.